Hi, my name's Rob Pine. I am the champion of the underdog. Thank you for coming to my new podcast, which you will hear regularly. I'll be talking to my friends, Anthony Mick, and anyone else who listens about all this shit that is going down. Good afternoon, thrill seekers. This afternoon, we are interviewing Australian legend, renowned environmentalist, thrill seeker, and lover of life, Anthony Too. Anthony, how are you today?
Hello, Robert. I'm very well, thank you. It's good to be here. How are you?
I'm very good, Anthony. Today I'd like to talk about sort of your life, your experience, and where you think we're going as a species. Are we up to that?
Yes, I think we can try chatting about that.
Anthony, you were born in what my mother's generation used to call the old country. Whereabouts were you born?
I was born in Leeds. It's St. Jimmy's Hospital, Leeds in England.
Geographically, whereabouts is Leeds? Is that in the north?
It's north of London. It's kind of Midlands, the skinny bit, as you're heading up towards Scotland.
Okay, and so you were born to... Tell us about your parents.
My mother was Anne Too. Her maiden name's Wilkinson, of Anglo-Irish descent. Her mum was an O'Connor, Granny O'Connor, and there's a lot of them about.
And Anne's still alive?
Anne is still alive. What is she? She's going to be 85. She lives in Newcastle in the Hunter Valley. Go the Knights. And my father was Meng Ah, and they split up shortly after I was born. And so mum came back to Australia with me and my two brothers to the New England region of New South Wales. And they're in Barnaby Joyce country.
So your father would have been of Chinese origin?
He was a Chinese man of Han Chinese descent.
Wow.
The great mass of them, Chinese.
And that would have been a cultural experience for your mother at the time?
I think so. I think that was part of the reason it happened. She was after cultural experiences.
Yep. And do you think mixed marriages in that way back then, which was a very different time, would that have put stresses on a relationship as well?
Oh, absolutely. I know that in her, where she grew up in the New England, was very conservative, very Catholic, and she certainly felt a lot of stress and strain because of it, and that was transferred to me and my brothers in different ways.
I know we've inherited it in Australia as well, but I think England's got its own sort of special brand of racism when you think of some of the white supremacists in the UK and the fact they were sort of, you know, living in mud caves when the Chinese had developed sophisticated forms of everything from fireworks to you name it. Marcus Polo founded it in China. And it is incredible, isn't it, that sort of ignorance that you can get.
Absolutely. It seems almost... in the DNA of those peoples who've come from a history of empire, of conquering nations that were not less sophisticated, in fact were more sophisticated in lots of ways, culturally and socially, but in terms of military power and the discipline of creating infrastructure, which is what the British and other colonial nations of Europe really excelled at.
And the British have had such an incapacity to understand their own decline and come to terms with it, a lack of willingness to come to terms with it. And that's why you see things like the Brexit vote. They're always feeling something's been taken from them, you know, and it's this chip on the shoulder. It's a pretty uneducated, but it plays to a big audience over there.
Absolutely. It's really fascinating, that narrative of entitlement that kind of comes with the history of being an empire and of conquering other nations, but is unfounded in terms of the intellectual and cultural capacity, or not capacity, that's the wrong word, the wherewithal of the peoples, the actual British people, on their low level of understanding of the mechanics of empire and colonialism.
The saddest thing for me is it's often Tory politicians or right-wing politicians that appeal to this sentiment. And in response, they get the vote, the very people that will oppress the ignorant and keep them down, you know?
Knowingly and deliberately they play that card, that race card, and knowing the sense of hurting that's coming out of those people who, because of the policies of the right wing and the neo-libs, yeah. because they're hurting, and then the politicians manage to misdirect it towards
that minorities. Hurt. Yeah, that hurt that you speak of, rather than being focused on those who cause it, focused on other vulnerable members in the community. It's so tragic in a way. It's like a tragic Shakespearean sort of play, isn't it, the way things unfold in that country?
Absolutely, it is. It is.
When, so your parents came to Australia together?
Well, no, my mother and my father, I think because of that, the tension around that race issue with him being a Han Chinese and my mother feeling the pull of family, the umbilicus taking her back to her family in New England, that his status as a Chinese man, I think there was something about the Communist Party. He was connected with the Communist Party. Yep. And apparently that was frowned upon also. And they both made the decision, which I don't fully understand, that he stayed in England, in Leeds, and went on to have another family and father my half-sister.
Yeah, well, I'm not seeking to sort of idealise Chinese culture either. That can be quite patriarchal, can't it? So that would have been something your mother would have been up against. The role of the woman, you know, would have been a challenge for her to accept as well, as a Western woman back then, probably.
Yes, I think so. Well, she came back to Australia and we moved to the town of Inverell in New England. And I lived there from 1966 to 1976.
And that's a farming area?
That's farming, wheat, cotton, cattle, sheep, all sorts of things there. Very hot in summer, dry heat, and very cold in winter.
That's where you developed your love of the environment?
Yes, it is. I was immersed in the bush there. I mean, I'd go to the river every day. I was walking beside it or along it to school. There was lots of goannas and echidnas and platypus in the river that ran through the town. Thunderbolt's Rock was not far from that town, and I used to go there, and there was goannas all over the place there. Yeah, I really did fall in love with the bush and with the Australian landscape there.
And you mentioned school. You went to a Catholic school?
I went to Sacred Heart Primary School, which is run by the nuns. And the Sisters of Mercy, I think they were. Or the Sisters of the Sacred Heart, perhaps. And then I went to Holy Trinity High School at Inverell, just for the first year seven there, before we then moved up to Newcastle.
We know from revelations in the media recently about some of the childhood sexual abuse that the Catholic, some of the Catholic priests engage in around that time. It's hard to look back now, but I believe the role of the Catholic priest was such in the community that no one would have complained of abuse because the Catholic priest was seen as beyond reproach. It's hard to believe that now, but that was the case?
That was absolutely the case. You know, I was immersed in that Roman Catholic culture. My mother was a strong believer. I was an altar boy as a child. I was often, me and other children were often left in the care of the stewardship of priests and nuns. And when we went to Newcastle, I was enrolled at Mars Brothers College in Hamilton, a particular school which has been shown to be really a centre of a number of terrible things that went on, of abuses.
Did you ever hear anything, or maybe look back at young boys who became withdrawn and wonder about what happened there?
Well, at the time, I was myself withdrawn. I was not abused myself, but I was withdrawn for my own reasons. And I didn't at the time think about it, although I was aware of other children around me who were, you know, suffering in various ways, who were tense, disengaged. In hindsight, I realise now that a number of them were being abused, and indeed it has come out in public in the revelations about the Catholic Church and the Mars Brothers in The Hunter, that some of my classmates were directly abused and have suffered greatly ever since, of course. And I know that some of the brothers, Mars Brothers, that taught me and had care of me, and some of the priests who I served as an altar boy for were also involved in those crimes.
Tragic. The tragic thing is that those in power knew about it and just transferred them to other areas where they could commit the same crimes over and over again.
Absolutely tragic and gobsmackingly, I don't know, it's hard to talk about, you know.
Yeah.
The fact that for generations and for so many years, so many of those abuses were committed with the knowledge of the hierarchy and the ignorance of the parents and the community. You have to think of ignorance, because if you think any other way, it becomes too difficult to deal with.
Yeah, that's right, to think, yeah. And you and the family moved into Newcastle. What part of Newcastle, and what prompted the move into town?
So my mother had been working as a assistant at the high school in Inverell, as a teacher's assistant, and she decided to study arts and get a teacher's degree. So she enrolled at Newcastle Teachers College to do that. That's why we moved from Inverell down to Newcastle. And so we moved into a house at Cooks Hill, which is a fairly central suburb right next to the Newcastle suburb itself, in the centre of town. And we moved in number 6 Brook Street in 1976.
So this is your mum, you, your brother?
My brother Marcel and my brother Stephen and me, yeah.
Okay.
The 4 of us.
Excellent. And around that time, you finished your high school there? And what happened post-high school?
I finished high school in 1982. I had been on a trajectory up until year 10 of being very smart and you know, top of the form and very good at English and history, science and French, hopeless at math, but good at the other things, the humanities and the... then I got to know beer. I discovered alcohol in year 10, at the end of year 10, and then a combination of that unhappiness at home, because my mother was very withdrawn, very sad about breaking up, never seeing her husband again, my dad, and the pressure of bringing up 3 teenage boys. My oldest brother, Stephen, was very withdrawn. Marcel was very wild. He was the middle child. He was wild and in trouble a lot. And I was quiet and withdrawn. And I took naturally to drinking. And year 11 and 12 were a bit of a washout for me. And I failed to matriculate.
Oh, well.
Surprised everyone.
Alcohol and sport are a big part of Australian youth. So was the alcohol tied with sporting activities and clubs as well?
It was, absolutely. I became competitive. I was playing football, soccer and cricket. And yes, it was very much part of the culture there. There was always drinks after the game, sponsored by the club, you know, free beers or a beer for the best player. And at the end of the season, the keg parties. And yeah, it was just de rigueur. That's what you did. So I threw myself into that.
And not long after this, we would have had the experience of the Newcastle earthquake. A lot of people seem to have forgotten about the Newcastle earthquake, but I can certainly remember that. I think that was back in about 1989. It shook Newcastle, and news of it shook the nation.
It did. I remember it vividly. I will never forget it. And I was there that morning. It was a normal morning. I was hungover, sleeping in. My friend Paul Ditz came around to collect me to go swimming. We went and did laps every morning. And he was in the room, and I just got up and was stretching, and everything started to shake. And there was this louder and louder noise, rumbling And me and Paul looked at each other and thought, you know, what are we? Are we still drunk? And then my mother screamed. And so we realised, no, this was really happening. We ran out onto the road out the front of the house. And I turned and looked to where the noise was coming from, which was towards the workers' club. It was only about 2 kilometres away. And the road, I swear, the road rippled. I watched this ripple and this roar come towards me over about 200 or 300 metres. And it lifted us up and dropped us down. And then there was this moment of quietness and then this almighty, God almighty roar and crash, which we realised later was the workers' club, Newcastle workers' club coming down. And I think 9 or 10 people were killed when that came down. And then there was silence for some tens of seconds and then chaos, absolute chaos. Vehicles, people, sirens, more and more sirens. And then for the next few days and nights, it was just sirens. It was incredible.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. And I think the reason the news travelled around Australia and caused such a stir was we don't consider that part of Australian life. That's part of New Zealand life. It's not a part of Australian life. Mm. And it was amazing. Now, I think one of your brothers by this time would have been a builder.
Marcel became a builder. When was that? So it was 89. He finished. Yeah, he was building then.
And that would have kept you and him busy in Newcastle after the earthquake, doing repairs and helping to people get their places back together, I suppose?
Absolutely. There was a lot of that work, a lot of demolition work, because there was buildings that were unsafe, had to be knocked down. So I really enjoyed that, getting dirty and sweaty. Then lots of building. Marcel then, he later on went on to work with roads and bridges. There is still now work going on because repairs were done and then more damage was found. There was subsidence all over the place. And so some properties are still dealing with the ramifications of that earthquake, even now, all this time later.
It is amazing, isn't it? Whether it's politics or natural disasters, they create a stir at the time and everybody moves on, but not everybody moves on. There's always some people whose lives will be impacted and who'll never completely get over it, you know?
I think
not
so.
To mention those who tragically lost their lives. Of course, their families are living with that forever.
I had my friend Peter McMahon. His father was killed. They were out shopping together as a family and they went in and he stayed out on the footpath in Hamilton in Beaumont Street and a shop awning fell and crushed him.
Wow.
So I know that family's still dealing with it and many others.
It's amazing though that fate is so, these things could quite easily not happen.
Mm.
It's just 1 second and
one
a
second
life's ended.
And decision.
And so you were working as a chippy, as a builder, builder's labourer there. You moved on. I know about 1989 you would have joined the, that would be about when you were going to join the Wilderness Society, wouldn't it?
That is correct. So we have to backtrack a bit and we go to 1988 and my oldest brother Stephen died of bowel cancer. Now, at that time, I was going along in my life fairly standard trajectory of an Aussie bloke, a working class bloke, doing that chippy work, and had no idea that that was about to happen, no idea that he was ill. And when we suddenly realised he was ill, it was his sickness had advanced. It was bowel cancer, and he couldn't be saved. So I had to suddenly deal with not just the fact of his imminent death, but of his isolation, his dealing with this sickness, which apparently he'd known about for, he had to have known about for a number of months, but we didn't know about. So it came out of the blue and really knocked me back, really messed me up.
Yeah.
And so I spent a number of months trying to come to terms with that. And during that time, I realised that there was an inherent emptiness or lack of substance to the life I was living. And I decided that I wanted to live a more meaningful life And so that prompted me then to look for something else other than the ordinary life. And some of my friends who looked after me while I was grieving were involved in this environment movement. So I thought I'd check it out. And I joined the Wilderness Society. I walked into the Wilderness Society shop in the Heritage Centre, an old, would have been an old jail in Newcastle. And I went and saw Trudy Bayer and Rodney Knight there, and I started doing volunteer shifts in the Wilderness Society shop in late 1989. But before too long, I was in the thick of the campaigning and really discovered that was my passion, and that I had a real talent for working with people and processing information about the environment. And yeah, my life changed, and things got better for me.
They were heady days for the environment movement, and it's nothing feels better than being part of a struggle, working with comrades for the collective good. But I guess one thing my grandmother said to me was, she was talking about a donkey that had been roped up behind the Grafton Hotel, funnily enough, many years ago. And she said, "No, it's our job to speak up for these animals, Rob, because they can't speak up for themselves." And that's something that I've always thought of about animal welfare. But you became very passionate about the continued survival of a species, namely the koala, which was coming under threat, especially from so much urban development and destruction of its habitat. Did you think back then you could win the battle for the survival of the koala?
Well, just to rephrase that, it was a battle for a landscape that would continue to support the koala and other species. And at the time, yes, I did. When I first started, and when I was full of the excitement of doing this work and working with people who were very switched on and very conscious, it seemed to me, of all the different dimensions of our life, of the modern life of Western society in Australia, and all these like veils were peeled from my eyes as I learned about the way the ecology of Australia, and I learned about the administration of environmental matters, and I learned about vested interests, and I learned about the ecosystem services that are inherent in every species, in every ecosystem, in every habitat. So I learned all that, and I thought to myself, well, this is so powerful and so important.
Yeah.
Surely society cannot fail to meet this challenge. And as you say, they were very heady days, and I was working with some incredible people, Bob Brown among them, people from the North East Forest Alliance in New South Wales, really remarkable people, who did so much work, hundreds and thousands of hours of people hours, doing computer work, doing survey work, and then doing blockades, stopping work, being arrested, going to court, working with legal teams, and winning battles. And there was a wave of environmental appreciation and consciousness going through the country and through New South Wales. There seemed to be reasons for optimism and hope, and we made some gains, and yeah, it was very heady. And
as people's eyes open, you feel inside yourself that other people and the movement will grow, and other people will understand what you understand. Tragically, it doesn't happen, does it?
It doesn't happen. And what I found was that it was very difficult for the community to sustain this wave of appreciation. As time went by, as the Howard government came in, as the forces of darkness, neoliberalism, capitalism, very, very basic business-oriented people, made decisions that was good for business but was ultimately bad.
It's really interesting you say that, because it seems to me I've seen so many campaigns over the years, and a group of local residents will get organised and may win a battle, but as long as we're living in a capitalist economy, it is that sheer weight of capital and that drive to increase capital that seems to overwhelm the forces of light and goodness that are seeking to protect the place. And I guess, I know I've been harping on the koala, but it just emphasises to me it really is a death of a thousand cuts, because this little development's not going to matter, that little development's not going to matter, and before you know it, there's nothing left.
Classic death of a thousand cuts, exactly as you say. And the while no, it's like with climate change, where you say climate, you can't say climate change caused this fire, but it made it much more likely, each individual event. And with the weight of business, the momentum that the business machine has, means that as each ecosystem falls, each development application is approved, it's a nail in the coffin. And the ultimate show of that, of course, was that we had this particular development was going on, which was threatening some koala habitat. It was also sugar glider habitat, some endangered fauna species. And this was, I think it was in 95. And by that time, I was, you know, a veteran and very experienced and working with a lot of experienced people. We ran a campaign, which was a textbook campaign. We did survey work. We raised funds. We hired specialists. And we got a barrister to go pro bono for us. And we won in the Land and Environment Court. It was a textbook campaign. And so a week after we had won that court decision, Bob Carr, who was then Premier of New South Wales, introduced a bill to the Parliament which basically overturned the court decision and allowed business to go on.
It's like you run a marathon and the community comes with you and you do all this and someone just writes a cheque and says, we'll appeal it, or we'll make a donation to a party that'll pass legislation. And where we're left today, of course, it's tragic, because I was going to ask you about your own hopes. Do you think there is a future for the koala in Australia? Is it doomed to extinction? But, of course, once you start saying that, the property developer says, well, they're going to go extinct anyway. What's, you know, you're really in a catch-22 situation. But what do you think? Do you think the species will have a long-term future?
There's a term that is bandied about now, which is the term of functional extinction. If you go to the concept of what is a minimum viable population, you've got to think about gene pools and the fragmentation of habitat and whether an isolated population has enough territory to support this population, which has enough of a gene pool to allow them to continue. Then the fact is that there are going to be a number of regional extinctions which are already occurring. And so in many areas, koala populations will disappear. That is a simple fact, given the fragmentation, given the increasing climatic pressures, given the ongoing pace of development that is going to happen.
And I apologise for the koala phase, because we're actually living at a time of the greatest mass extinction that probably the planet's ever experienced. And it's tragic to think of the recent bushfires, how many of those animals might not come back.
That's right. They're now... They said 1 billion shortly after the fires, and now they're saying as many as 3 billion creatures that were either killed or impacted, whether they can't survive because of that damage and the ongoing threat to their habitat. The Anthropocene, we're in this pointy end of the Anthropocene, and extinctions are happening in waves. And yes, it's a very, really alarming time. I have to say that with the weight of my experience and looking at ecosystems around the world through that lens of the fight against development, which we are losing, it's hard to see how many species are going to make it.
Well, after that that period of fighting some wins, some losses, and immense personal growth you experienced, you moved to the Daintree in far north Queensland. We don't get many bushfires up here, but you moved up here in 1998.
That's correct, yeah. I started a relationship with a woman that I met in Brisbane, and we decided to move up to the Daintree, up to be near her parents, and to move into a house that they'd bought with their super at a little place called Wonga Beach.
I know it well.
Yeah, and I we got there in late 98, and for a year and a half I did odd jobs. I did a lot of cleaning work in hotels, and then I lucked into meeting an owner of a boat tourism business on the Daintree River, and he said to me that if I'd get a coxswain's ticket, he'd give me a job as a tour guide. And I thought I'd give it a whirl. I liked the idea of working on a river, working in a beautiful environment after all the work I'd done to protect areas. And so I found myself being a tour guide and boat skipper on the Daintree River starting in the year 2000.
And you saw a lot of crocodiles, pointed a lot of crocodiles out to people?
I did. I come to know the crocodile population in Daintree very well, and applied probably the lower 20 to 30 k's of the river, and saw a lot of crocodiles, a lot of snakes, a lot of frogs, a lot of beautiful birds, lots of different weather, and it was really a wonderful time in my life.
This was not too long after the Daintree blockade. Did you get involved with the environment movement in the area? Or?
Look, when I first got there, you know, after having done that really intense work for 10 years, it was just like second nature. And I looked into the reef campaign, and I started doing some work on trawling and trying to limit the trawling activity and the use of chains dragged along the bottom to encourage prawns and other things up into the nets. But then the reality, and my partner got pregnant with my first son, and of course she had her own child, my stepson, so there was a lot of care there, and I had to work a fair bit to pay for things. And so I found the tyranny of distance, being in the Daintree away from the cities, and the family pressures, made it really impossible for me to do the level of work I had done.
Our good friend Julia Loy was the mayor of the Douglas Shire, including all that area, until the last local government elections in 2020. And I believe the new mayor for that area is looking at supporting a bridge across the Daintree River. I'm guessing you wouldn't support that sort of initiative?
Look, as I often say, you know, we discussed this on the river. We discussed it as a community in the Daintree, and we discussed it along the river. And as time went along, it came apparent to me, although a lot of the community was opposed to a bridge being built, and a lot of the community was opposed to mains power being put over the river, there was also a core of people who were very supportive of the bridge and the power, and that as the pace of development went along and as world interest in the Daintree increased, and we were getting tens of thousands of visitors, becoming one of the most visited natural areas. I think after Uluru, we were perhaps the most visited natural area in Australia. And it became apparent to me that the increasing pressures on the landscape meant they would have to upgrade the infrastructure.
Okay.
And I said to people, it may be inevitable that they will build a bridge, maybe not in 10 years or 20 years, but eventually, if this keeps up. And if they do, they must do it tastefully. They must do it with a full suite of environmental investigations and regulations. It is a fact, though, that putting a bridge there is a massive development. The roadworks either side of the bridge to withstand a 1-in-100-year flood event on the Daintree, which floods regularly, which has flood levels 5 metres, 10 metres, historically a 12-metre flood level, I think, in the 80s. So the amount of work and infrastructure that goes with that bridge is massive, and that has two implications. One, it will have a huge impact on the ecosystem, on the mangroves, on the cassowary population, because there'll be 24 hours of traffic, there'll be more traffic, faster traffic, and it'll be a bit like the koala situation, because the habitat will be fragmented and there'll be huge impacts. But then, of course, the bridge and road will bring more people, more business, and I think it will lead to dire outcomes for the rainforest.
Well, it would have been around, I'm trying to think of what year it would have been, but Your kids would have been at school, and that would have been the 2014 that your marriage broke up and you moved. Did you move to Cairns?
I moved to Cairns, yes.
What year would that have been?
That was in January of 2015, I moved into West Court after, you know, a year of difficulties up in the Dane Tree. And I started to do a double diploma of counselling and community services. I was still going back and forth on weekends. I was going and doing some fill-in work up on the river.
Yep.
But I was spending my weeks studying down in Cairns.
And around that time, I gave you a job in our office. I was a local member for Cairns in the state parliament, and you worked for us there for a while, and we were involved in a lot of joint campaigns around the Stop Adani movement in particular.
At that time, it was gas. I was in the CSG Free, that is Coal Seam Gas Free Far North Queensland group, because a mining company had been given a lease over a 10-year at Mount Mulligan, west of Cairns, which is known as Garabulgan to the Western Yalanji and the other people, their name will come to me. Jungan. The Jungan and the Western Yalanji country. So we were mounting this campaign to stop this coal seam gas mine. And I came to see you with our friend Bob Davis to ask you to support our campaign against this coal seam gas operation, which you did support, and you and I discovered a friendship and a common kind of position on these environmental issues. And so we were seeing each other around at different events. And then, yes, you offered me the job and I was happy to take it.
We were stupid enough to believe that you actually represented your constituents. And when you look at, we represented the electorate of Cairns there, an area that's obviously going to be underwater as the sea level rises. And combating fossil fuels and sort of pushing on the issue of climate change, I thought was the most important thing we could do. So we gave it a red hot go anyway.
We did. And, you know, you, in your role, you were very engaged in all different sectors of the community and dealing with different issues. And working in the electorate office, I learned a lot about those community issues, and we gave all of them a red hot go, but as you say, the climate issue was the clear existential threat. None of the other things we worked for in the community will stand the test of time if we don't deal with this issue properly.
Exactly, and around this time you would have met your new partner, Kate.
That's right, I met Kate. I was living with her sister, Christine. Christine's a well-known entity around the inner city of Cairns and the western suburbs. She deals with Indigenous issues as a freelance journalist.
And doesn't she work for the national newspaper, the Murray Times?
The Koori. Koori Times. She's been working for them for many years, and she does newsletters for Yarrabah and Palm Island and covers special events in the Indigenous community. She's very well known and well developed in that community. And anyway, I was living with her, renting a room at her place in West Court, and naturally I met her sister Kate and discovered that she was very lovely, and I asked her, and yeah, we've been together since December of 2015.
And on that lovely note, we might finish our interview for today. The next chapter, who knows where that will take you, I guess. Thanks for sharing your experience and your journey to where you got, how you got to Cairns, and what you've been doing since you've been here. And I look forward to continuing to engage with you and our listeners on this new thing we call this podcast.
That's wonderful, Robert. Thank you. It's been a pleasure. And let's fight. Fight the power.
Exactly. Champion of the underdog. Good on you, brother. Okay, bye for now.
Bye-bye.